stories or not?
Sure. Astronaut stories.
Tape 4, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History Number 2, November 20, 1991, Gabby Denman interviewing Mike Levine. Mary Harrison is the recorder. Mike, at the end of tape 3, you had just mentioned Helen Hayes. What do you have to
say? Well, I mentioned that I had met some actors and actresses when I was an usher. I remember Helen Hayes distinctly because she's little, very much like my Aunt Bess. And I remember her fondly. She was very sweet. Donald Cook, her leading man in whatever play they were doing. You know, it's hard to believe that we had a continuous series of live performances, theater performances at the Nixon, almost all year round. Mm-hmm. I saw the 5 Barrymores perform together. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that happened very often. I don't think many people can say. It was a terrible play. It was just an awful play. But there were all 5 Barrymores performing in a thing called All My Children, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it was a turkey. But there they were in all their glory. I met Maurice Evans, the great Shakespearean. He did Hamlet. And it was a tour de force. It was a 5-hour play. And this man was so spellbinding. I remember the theater was filled, and the only place that the ushers could see the program was to sit on the steps in the balcony. And I sat on the steps for 5 hours watching Maurice Evans be Hamlet. I was a kid then. Can you imagine? He was so wonderful as an actor. He had this kid transfixed. It was marvelous. Anyhow, I met a lot of actors, and that was a great experience for me when I was young.
Was there any Yiddish theater that came to Pittsburgh?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
It may have come for special performances at the Y. They had a concert series. They've always had a concert series and live performances. When they were in Oakland, they had a huge auditorium there, and they may have done some Yiddish theater. It seems to me that they did, but I can't speak with any certainty about that.
Okay. Do you have any other astronaut stories?
Well, we were close to the astronauts. We ate with them. We played with them. We worked alongside them, and I got to know all of them. They were all very special men. They were all pilots. Too, you know, in the early days, for some reason or other, they seemed to think that flying was a prerequisite for space travel, a ridiculous concept. But we got to meet them and know them. Scott Carpenter, I remember, impressed me one day. He carried an old-fashioned coin purse in his pocket, which he had made from how can I say this? It was made from a kangaroo scrotum. I'm sorry.
No.
He was, in addition to being a marvelous pilot and a clever astronaut and a handsome devil and a really adventurous guy, he was also good on horseback, and he went on kangaroo hunts when he was... eventually, all the astronauts had to tour all of the navigational stations. There was a worldwide network of stations that kept the spacecraft pinpointed. When he was in Australia, on the west coast of Australia, there was one of the navigational stations and communications relay station to the spacecraft. And while he was out there, he went on a kangaroo hunt on horseback and got a trophy of the hunt. It was tanned and made into a wallet sort of thing for him. Weird, huh?
Sounds so.
Not a very nice story, but...
Probably carried it as a, what do you call that? A good luck charm.
Oh, yeah. They all had good luck charms. John Glenn had, well, I referred to him as the Eagle Scout. He did have a Boy Scout pin of some kind that was his. They were forbidden to take anything in the spacecraft. And, of course, as soon as they were told not to do it, they all did. All of them wrapped something around their some flag or some token of their wife, some of the scarf, and they all had something wrapped around their bodies. Incidentally, in the early days of the space program, they looked everywhere for a lining for the spacesuit. You know, the spacesuit was, I put that thing on and had my picture taken, and it was a real thrill, but it's like a huge big bubble that encases the whole body. They needed some kind of a soft lining for that, and they found just the perfect item that had apertures where they were needed at the appropriate places and could be easily climbed into and out of, and they buttoned up at the right places. And they got, in order to get a lining suit within the suit for the spacecraft, they got the Sears Roebuck long johns. So I got to meet seven astronauts in their underwear. At one time or another, I interviewed them all in their long johns.
You mentioned...
Yeah, I mentioned interviewing President Kennedy in his underwear.
Oh, yes,
while he was
did,
on the campaign trail. Maybe I ought to do famous people I've interviewed in their underwear.
Oh, my God. How about it? Did you interview Nikita Khrushchev in his underwear, or what is
no,
that?
No, he was all dressed up, but he was touring in Pittsburgh. He was part of a nationwide tour, and he had an entourage of bodyguards, security men from Russia and the United States, and the city police, and you just couldn't get near him. And there was a pool of assignment reporters from the National Press Corps that followed him, and the local reporters were always kept at a distance. He was down in West Homestead at the Mesta Machine Works, visiting and talking to steelworkers. And I was standing on a pile of slag way off in the distance, and I was 100 feet away from him, and I desperately had my tape recorder. I desperately wanted to catch his attention, and I shouted the one word in Russian that I know, it's Tavarish, and I yelled, "Hey, Tavarish," and son of a gun, if it didn't catch his eye.
What's that mean, Tavarish?
Friend.
Okay.
Or comrade, or whatever, but it's more than, it's not a term of affection, but it's I think it's a formal title for a friend. But anyhow, it caught his attention. He came, I don't know what it means. It means something about, hey, buddy. And he came over, and I got an exclusive interview with him. And he had just given his wristwatch to one of the steelworkers as a souvenir. And I kept thinking through the interview, oh, boy, I'm going to get a present from the prime minister, the premier of the Soviet Union. And I did. I got a little bottle of, a little jar of caviar and a record. It's around the house here somewhere, I think. A very bad Russian music, popular music from the Soviet Union in those days. And it was a kind of a scoop to get an interview with him. He was very kind, very gracious, and had a really nice. I really walked off. I don't think anybody at all got an exclusive one-on-one interview with him as I did. It was on that visit that. You know, I'm a tour guide now. I take tourists around the city, and when we get to the University of Pittsburgh's Cathedral of Learning, we park across the street at the Student Union building, and I tell them that that's where Nikita Khrushchev told us that they would bury us. And that's it was on that visit that I heard him say that they would bury us. And I don't think he meant that they would bury us underground in a grave. I think he meant that they would bury us. We would be so far behind them in their dust, in the race that he challenged us to, a race for the building of hospitals, universities, and highways, that they would leave us so far behind in their dust that we would be buried. And it was in that sense that he said they would bury us. But he said that at the old Shenley Hotel, which is now the Pitt Student Union, the same place, incidentally, where United States Steel was created by a committee of about 40 millionaires back when your grandfather was just a kid. But the old Shenley Hotel is a historic place, and that's where I got married, and that's where Nikita Khrushchev made the speech, and I heard him say they'd bury us, and I loved him because he gave me an exclusive interview. That was Nikita Khrushchev.
That's exciting. Do you have any other scoops? I'm sure you do, but any that might interest us.
One day, Life magazine sent a photographer to ride around with me because there were very few radio reporters driving around covering news with the mobile radio news unit. In that day, there had been a holdup earlier in the day before I picked up the photographer. Somebody heard my description on the air of the getaway car and saw the bank robbers leaving the scene. The bank was robbed in the Hayes section.
Hayes section?
Yeah, that's Hayes is a section of the city that's out toward West Mifflin, almost all the way beyond West Homestead. And there was a tiny little bank that was robbed by these bad guys, and they got away. Two of them got away with the loot, but somebody got their license number and a description of their car. And I covered the holdup and broadcast the description of the getaway car. And somebody in Mount Oliver, a businessman there, was actually looking out on Brownsville Road, saw the car in front of his place of business when I was describing it. And he called the cops, and that touched off a chase that lasted for miles, all the way from Mount Oliver, through Brentwood, through Castle Shannon, and over into Dormont. At one point, we were getting reports on the police radio. At one point, the police chief of Green Tree Borough was stuck in traffic in a line of cars facing in one direction when he saw the robber's car go past him in the other direction. He was going away from Green Tree. They were going toward Green Tree, and he went crazy.
Sounds like an Italian movie.
They set up a roadblock in Green Tree, and the holdup guys crashed through it. And they were eventually chased to a dead-end street on the side of Chicken Hill, near the Green Tree neighborhood. And on the side of Chicken Hill, a gunfight broke out. I had the photographer with me. When I went to the side of Chicken Hill and we watched, it was a hot summer day and I was broadcasting the shooting. You could hear the guns going off. And it lasted for about an hour. Incredibly, it was right near the West End bypass of the Penlingen Parkway. I don't think the tunnels had opened yet. But there was a crowd of thousands of people standing on the side of the road on the Penlingen Parkway watching the cops shoot it out with these two bad guys. And I was broadcasting the whole thing. You could hear them with blazing guns. I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, it was like a comedy. The public safety director was running around like a chicken with his head cut off. His name was Louis Rosenberg. He went on to become a respected member of the federal court bench. He's now, but at that time he was the safety director, and he was Looney Tunes. I mean, the job went to his head. And he was running around like a stage director, managing the shootout. There were cops at the foot of the hill, the bad guys up on the top of the hill, and they were blazing away at each other. There was a policeman wounded, shot through the buttocks, believe it or not. And one of the holdup men was shot, and they eventually captured the two of them, but I covered the whole damn thing, got an interview with one of the robbers as they took him away. And that became... Incident Life magazine took pictures of the whole thing, and the pictures never did appear in Life magazine, but they published a South American edition, and it made the Life magazine's South American edition, the shootout at Chicken Hill. The gunfight lasted for a long time, and it was the live broadcast of that gunfight that made me famous.
It's a good title, The Shootout on Chicken Hill.
Well, there was another shootout where a demented mental patient from the Veterans Hospital at Leech Farm came back to the hospital with a big gun and held his psychiatrist hostage in an office. And there was a shootout on the campus there of the... Veterans Hospital. It's a sprawling hospital with wings here and wings there, and the cops were on one side of the quadrangle shooting into this office where the nutcake was holding his doctor hostage, and I was able to get into the office next door. There was tear gas and the whole nine yards, but I was able to get in, and the switchboard operator at the Veterans Hospital was gracious enough to put me through to KDKA. And they put me on the air, and we were broadcasting the shootout. Well, it sounds like cops and robbers, and it was really as ludicrous as it sounds. And I broadcast there were cops in the corridor outside, and you could hear them shouting to each other. And there were cops outside in the quadrangle. They brought up a Brinks truck, an armored truck, and they found that they couldn't shoot very conveniently from through the gun slots in the sides of the armored truck. So the truck, they brought in guys with deer rifles. And the doctor was eventually killed, dead as a doornail, and so was the nutcake. The metal patient was just shot dead. I believe both of them were probably killed by police bullets. But that gunfight lasted for, and I was just a few feet away from, you could hear the bullets hitting, and it was really exciting. So that was another little news story that caught the interest of the listeners here, and but it was Reed Cordick that did the parody of Mike Ravine. He had in Reach Cordick did those morning humor little excerpts in his DJ program, and he had a stable of guests that included Louis the Garbage Man, Brunhilde, and you know the fictitious characters that used to entertain so much. He was very, very popular, and one of the characters in his entourage of people in Reach Cordick's circle of friends in his little studio when he was on the air. One of his guys was a roving reporter named Mike Ravine. And Mike would do such things as when the World Series would be played between Minneapolis and Chicago, he would do a report from Yankee Stadium and be bewildered by the fact that there was nobody there for the first game of the World Series. Mike Ravine did muffled reports, and it was very funny because he was making fun of the way that I screamed and yelled and got excited when we covered fires and floods and God knows how many fires and how many floods I covered, but and shootouts, and but it was, believe it or not, Reach Cordick's character Mike Ravine that made me well known around town, perhaps even more than covering the exciting news stories that I covered.
Shootouts. Were you involved at all in the Kent State?
Oh, yeah, on the talk show. By then I was doing the talk show, yeah. And the Kent State thing. I was not on campus at the time that it happened. I went there the day after, or a couple of days after, but we were talking about it, and that's a very unpleasant memory for me. I was vilified because I sympathized with the students. It's impossible for me to tell you the level of hatred and alienation and polarization in the community, but there were many, many people who called my program to say that those kids asked for it and they got what they deserved, and people incredibly said they were glad that the four students who died, they were glad they were killed, and they should shoot more of them. I was opposed to the war and said so publicly on the station. It is to their everlasting credit that they let me do that. But I was, as I said, vilified because I was opposed to the war and sympathetic to the students at Kent State. We were the closest major station to Kent State, and it was Arthur Krause, who died quite recently, the father of Allison Krause, one of the victims, was on my program frequently, and I get choked up now thinking about the terrible tragedy of young American servicemen in the National Guard opening fire and deliberately shooting into a crowd of students. It boggles the mind. It's just one of the, it's an everlasting American tragedy that there was so much hatred and opposition to that war at that time, that the situation could explode, erupt into a tragedy of the sort that happened on the campus at Kent State. And we talked about it every day. But there was pro and con, and I was really, a lot of people were sympathetic to me, but mostly I got a lot of hatred and criticism because I thought that it was terrible that, as I said at that time, those kids were murdered. And that got a lot of reactionary, adverse criticism. A lot of people hated me for that.
Were there other programs that you remember? that were outstanding one way or the other? I mean, controversially outstanding.
Well, the whole war, the Vietnam War, it became very controversial. While I was a reporter in New York, I covered 8 riots.
You mentioned that.
I don't know how I couldn't recite them, but then I came back, and then the talk show was just transfixed on that subject. It was a whole continuing thing.
Pittsburgh then and now. Do you have some comparisons as far as, well, you mentioned, of course, personalities coming through much more often than now. The life, the Jewish life, the family life.
I've seen, I don't know what way Murray Avenue is heading, but I've seen Murray Avenue deteriorating. I mean, there was a time when, in what is now called the Lower Hill District, there were a lot of mom-and-pop stores where Jewish people shopped for kosher products and foods, and there were bakeries on Logan Street and Lower Fifth Avenue, because there had been a Jewish colony in the Hill District. Well, that's disappeared. That's gone. And Murray Avenue used to be much more flourishing with small businesses than it is today. Butcher shops, bakeries. Herman's Bakery. Max Sherb, whose father owned the bakery, was a friend of mine at college. But I see Murray Avenue deteriorating, and the number of Jewish, just the character and the nature of Jewish community life is changing a whole lot. And I guess it was better then than it is today.
You mentioned you're a member of Temple Sinai. How new or how old is Temple Sinai? Is relatively new, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's they moved into they bought the old Worthington Mansion at the corner of Forbes Avenue and Yemshkadoran Street. I forget the name of the street. And then built a sanctuary alongside the mansion. But my parents were founding members of Bethel when it started in Beachview, and they were founding members of Temple Emmanuel when it was founded in Mount Lebanon. And I don't know, I'm trying to get involved in Jewish life in mm-hmm. Temple Sinai, and it was better when I was a kid. I think the community was more acquainted with one another. Maybe it was because we were a smaller South Hills Jewish community then. But I'm not qualified to make an analysis of Jewish community life.
Okay. Pittsburgh life in general.
There have been a lot of... I was a witness to a very small segment of life in Pittsburgh. I saw the civil rights movement begin here.
You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it began, inconspicuously enough, with black organizations, the NAACP, just one, getting together and picketing. I think the first confrontation was with the Duquesne Light Company. They picketed the Duquesne Light Company's headquarters, or was it the gas company? Downtown Pittsburgh, they had I guess it was the Duquesne Light Company. They wanted jobs, and they were picketing the company because the company didn't had an overt policy of not hiring blacks, and they wanted that changed. And the first picket line was a relatively peaceful affair, and they picketed around in a circle around two sides of the Duquesne Light Company building on 6th Street in downtown Pittsburgh. They staged marches. I saw the Black Panthers come to town briefly, and they staged parades demanding representation in the building trades union. I mentioned that because I think that They were misled, they were lied to, they were cheated because they demanded representation in the apprentice programs in the building trades unions, and they demanded a right to be represented in the hiring halls, and they wanted jobs given to black people in the building trades. And they had all kinds of agreements worked out, and it was supposed to be their entree into the building trades. Well, if you look at the construction project anywhere around the Pittsburgh district today, 30 years later, or any highway paving job, you look at them today, and there are no black people. There are no black people. I've seen the civil rights movement. Boy, it was, there were hardworking people. Martin Luther King came to Pittsburgh a couple times.
Did you meet him?
Sure, I met him. Mal Good introduced me to Martin Luther King. Mal Good is a black newsman from, he was with the Courier then, I believe. No, he was with ABC. He was their token black. When I met Martin Luther King, I can't remember where the hell it was. It was not Pittsburgh, but when he came to Pittsburgh, I was able to, I would always have to tell him I'm Mal Good's friend. And even though I was white, I could get an interview. I liked him. I liked him a lot. I believe that he was a truly dedicated man, and honestly felt the cause that he was working for. I've always had a lot of contempt for Jesse Jackson. Maybe I shouldn't talk about that.
You can talk about anything.
I had a television talk show once, and Jesse Jackson was the guest, and he came with a group of cronies, sycophants. They laughed when they were supposed to laugh, and they cheered when they were supposed to cheer. There were more than a dozen of them. And I remember, I don't know the context, I don't know how it happened, I know that they guffawed and laughed and laughed and laughed when he called me Whitey. That was live. We did live shows in those days. And that was Jesse Jackson. I've since met him maybe a score of times, dozens of times. And I've never gotten over my dislike of him and my suspicion about his sincerity. I've met him when I worked in other cities. I met him when I worked here in Pittsburgh. And I still wonder whether he's anything other than a charlatan. But I remember my father loathed and despised the man because he insulted me live on TV. And, I shouldn't talk about it. I should talk about pleasant memories, right?
No, you have to talk about them. Do you have any comment on the recent election in Louisiana?
No, but I've always had a lot of respect for the people who were fighting the Klan, and I think that Klan Watch in Georgia and the government neighborhood legal services, or the version of it that's in the South, are fighting the Klan, and they've discovered quite recently that the way to hit the Klan and make it hurt is to fight them in court, make them spend money on lawyers. And this new strategy was beginning to pay off when I've seen America now becoming more, not only is the civil rights program in the absence of enlightened, dedicated men, noble people like Martin Luther King, and I've seen it falling into the hands of the likes of Jesse Jackson, and the civil rights in America is not what it used to be, but I saw them making kind of good progress in the fight against bigotry, but I see now that the civil rights program is virtually dormant, and I see bigotry spreading, not only racially, but religious hatred, and I think David Duke is my enemy, and I think he is, we're going to hear a lot about him.
Okay, as a report, do you think that he's that the fact that he's being interviewed at all the talk shows is good or bad?
Well, I know. I know that it's helping him a great deal. Sure. Absolutely. And it's, while it's the news people, people like Larry King, like to think that they're exposing him, but they're not. I would never interview anybody on my talk show. I refused. Never would I ever have a guest from the Klan or from any of those hate groups. And there are a bunch of them in America, and they're still alive. Maybe not flourishing the way they used to, but I decided that to give them any exposure at all is to give them an entree, a foot in the door, and exposure and publicity and sympathy in some quarters that they might not otherwise get. So I've always refused to. I never had a steadfast policy against giving them free time on the air. And I never had seers and fortune tellers either. ESP, the psychics, and the sort. I never put fakes and charlatans on either. A couple of personal policies that I've taken, carried over from my news experience into my role as a talk show host. But I see hatred spreading in America today.